Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the course on building blocks and services of the SharePoint platform. In the last module, we talked with Scott Hillier about using the REST API to interact with SharePoint lists, list data. After we had Ted here talking a little bit about building SharePoint lists with XML and with managed code. So in this module, we're going to pivot a little bit and talk a little bit about CSOM. So Ted, why don't you tell us a little bit about the details about what exactly we're going to cover in this module?
Okay. Well, in this module, deep dive into SharePoint lists with CSOM APIs, we'll start with a little motivation about why we care, why we use the CSOM. Also, I think it's fair to say after that last module that Andrew is fairly excitable about the REST API. And the REST API is kind of a newer, bigger thing where, you know, you could argue that we've had the client-side object model since SharePoint 2010. So you have to find additional motivation to use the CSOM over the REST API today. So we'll explore a little bit of that. We'll go into the basically how to get started, optimizing CSOM queries. And then we want to just get some stuff done. So creating lists, creating event receivers are things that we'll look at through the course. Well, let's start with just a little bit of motivation, and I'll kind of put over to you for the vision of what we're after here.
So we talked about this vision in all of these different modules, and basically what we want to just mention here is that Microsoft has a central vision for Office 365 development, and it really centers around three different pillars: extend Office to everywhere, connect to Office services, and build using the open platform. The first pillar of this platform is giving us the ability to use all of the different tools, both the client and the server products, from Yammer to SharePoint to Outlook to Word, to really build a really good cohesive story around the entire Office platform. The second pillar around connecting to the Office 365 services is giving us the ability to use things like the REST API that Ted's going to talk about in this module, or the CSOM API that Ted's going to talk about in this module, and the REST API that we talked about in the last module. And then I'm also using some of the other Office 365 APIs around files and calendar and such. And then the last pillar of this vision is being able to do this really anywhere you want to do it, any platform using any technology from all the different things you see here on the slide. So it's not an exhaustive list, but it's just you really, there are tools available for you in just about every development environment and every platform so you can use what you want to use. So Ted, this whole thing about like the REST, the CSOM API and the REST API, where does the CSOM API fit into like the overall SharePoint building blocks?
Well, if we look at the building blocks we're looking at, you know, as we go through the module of this course, CSOM and what we talked about, the SharePoint REST API, are two somewhat competing technologies to achieve the same goal. There's going to be some benefits of, you know, one over the other and vice versa. But what we're trying to do is to write procedural code, possibly behind a web page with JavaScript, possibly inside of your remote web using C# or VB.net. And we're trying to do things like go to a site, maybe the host web, maybe the app web, create a list, hook up an event handler to that, possibly create child sites, create document libraries, write code to, once you create the document library, configure versioning and required checkout the way that your organization wants to do it. And what we see is that there's just seems to be, over the last 5 years, a very big move away from doing things declaratively with XML to doing things procedurally. I think Andrew's already tipped his hat. He likes the SharePoint REST API. But what now I'm going to try to do is kind of motivate some scenarios, you know, where maybe CSOM would be a better choice. So let's start, you know, now that with SharePoint 2013 and Office 365, the client-side object model is no longer the new kid on the block. The SharePoint REST API is, what would be some advantages of using CSOM over the REST API? And I think the first one comes down to productivity from strongly typed programming. So what we're going to see when we use CSOM is that if you're using C# in server-side code, you have strongly typed assemblies, and you get IntelliSense that's kind of leading you through how to use the API, where when using the SharePoint REST API, you have to figure out the shapes of the JSON payloads that you have to send back and forth across. So to me, there's a level of productivity. Some people really like C# over JavaScript. We won't get into whether that's right or wrong, but if you like to work with C# over JavaScript, CSOM might be a good choice for you. Today, with the released versions, CSOM has a big advantage over the SharePoint REST API, and then you can batch operations together. You know, so think about a case where you have to add 1,000 items to a SharePoint list. With the REST API, you're talking about 1,000 round trips across the network. With CSOM, you're talking about one round trip or 1,000 round trips or 10 round trips or whatever you figure, you know, whatever you discover is your optimized batch size. So doing more in fewer round trips and thus optimizing things, you know, would be another advantage. And I think we'll also still find a couple areas where they don't have REST coverage where there is CSOM coverage. You know, things like dealing with taxonomies and managed metadata that we'll deal with in the very last module of the course. It's just an example of one of those areas where, as much as Microsoft intended to have complete, you know, equality in the coverage of the SharePoint REST API and CSOM, that's not the way it is 100% across the board today. Okay, well, let's start with a quick overview of the client-side object model. I suspect that some of the people, watching this, some of you have worked with SharePoint before and familiar with the CSOM. Others are probably new to SharePoint altogether, so the CSOM is somewhat new for them. Now, let's start with what's the functionality of the client-side object model? What can you do inside your code? And for starters, think about the scope of a site collection and inside of the site collection. So we have a couple new CSOM APIs that are just emerging to create site collections, but there's really nothing to manage site collections at this point. So if you kind of think of your average business solution of within a site collection, I want to create a hierarchy of sites, I want to create lists, I want to create document libraries, maybe I want to go the whole full nine yards and create site columns and content types, and then lists and document libraries based on that. I want to add child sites, I want to add web part pages and add web parts or app parts to those pages. You know, those are just examples of what we can do with the client-side object model. Now, one of the things that has really changed in the client-side object model from SharePoint 2010 to SharePoint 2013 is the scope of what's covered. If we look back to SharePoint 2010, while we had the client-side object model, we can really say it stopped at SharePoint Foundation boundaries and didn't allow us to get to things like executing searches or dealing with managed metadata. And so as Microsoft put this proposal that we want you to move away from farm solutions and we want you to move to the new app model, all of a sudden the server-side APIs were no longer of any use. And so back in SharePoint 2010, where you had to use server-side APIs to get to a lot of the SharePoint server services, now it's been expanded, so CSOM covers things such as managed metadata, taxonomies, user profiles, executing searches, working with workflow. You know, so we can basically just say there's a lot more coverage of what the client-side object model can do compared to what we had in SharePoint 2010. Now, the entry point or the high-level architecture is somewhat the same from SharePoint 2010. And that is within a SharePoint web server, within the IIS website, there is this virtual directory that's been part of SharePoint for well over a decade called _vti_bin. And in SharePoint 2010, they put the client.svc file inside there. Now, one of the things when you use the client-side object model, you as a developer do not directly access the client.svc file. Instead, you're going to go through some type of proxy mechanism. So if you're using .NET code, you're going to reference some assemblies that we'll look at in just a second. We'll basically program against proxy classes, and behind the scenes, they will deal with all the WCF plumbing to actually issue the requests and deal with the responses coming back. Now, it turns out, as we saw in the last lecture, that this entry point now Microsoft is using for the SharePoint REST API too. So if you're using the SharePoint REST API, you're going to go to this directly, but instead of _vti_bin/client.svc, you're going to basically use _API. But then again, when we're doing CSOM programming, we're not referencing the URLs directly, so it's all kind of handled behind the scenes for us. Now, when it comes time to actually using the client-side object model, let me go ahead and move over to a sample application. I just have a simple client-side or a console app here for my first demo. And if we look under references, we'll see that there are two SharePoint.client and Microsoft.SharePoint.client.runtime. Also note that these two have both a 15 and a 16 version. So typically I like to go with the 16 versions. Now notice that if I add a reference here, and now we'll go and we'll say SharePoint.client, what we're going to see is that I've already added the 16 versions, but what you'll see is that the client and the client.runtime are the two mandatory assemblies you need every time you program against the client-side object model. But then you might additionally choose some of these other ones, such as publishing, document management, taxonomy. And one thing that you can get into is if you mistakenly have the 15 versions of client and client.runtime, but then you take the 16 version of client taxonomy, you're going to have a problem. So generally, just go with all the same version. If you're dealing with Office 365, just take the 16 versions inside there. Okay, well, now that we've got that, well, we want to go ahead and start doing some work against that. Now, let me move back to a couple more slides. So we've seen that there are basically DLLs that you will use if you're using the .NET version. And the typical usage case for this would be you're writing server-side C# or VB.NET code in a SharePoint provider-hosted app. Now, note that what you're going to be doing is programming against objects, and you're going to be calling this method called execute query. And what I wanted to show here is that, you know, as we're using this inside, if I look down here at the bottom of my screen, I basically have a little screenshot of Fiddler. And what Fiddler will show you is the URLs, basically, of the requests. And if you have CSOM requests being issued from your local machine, you're going to be able to see a underscore VTI underscore bin slash client.svc slash process query. And by looking in Fiddler at both the request and response, you can see that they send across the request just basically as an XML document that has one or more commands, and the response comes back as JavaScript object notation. Now, you're never going to touch the JavaScript object notation. It's going to be unpacked and put back in the objects for you, but for troubleshooting, it can definitely help to use Fiddler as a tool so you can inspect both the requests and the responses that are coming back. Now, let's say I was just using the client-side object model, you know, maybe inside of a desktop application, inside of an on-premises farm. You know, here is just your typical hello world where there is this important class which is known as the client context. And the simplest usage is we call new on the client context class. We pass in the constructor the URL to a particular site. So the client context really represents a connection to a site collection that is going to give you access to the sites inside there. As we'll see, when we make the connection, we can make the connection as a user, as an authenticated user. We can make the connection as an authenticated app that might be something with app-only identity, or it might be an app that's recognized with app identity and user identity. You know, so those are all different options that we have. Also, as I just quickly look down this first sample, you can see that if you're familiar with the server-side object model, we have classes like SPSite for the site collection, SPWeb for the site. And so in the client-side object model, they just strip off the SPs and the class names. So we have a site object that represents the site collection, and the client context has a site property. Likewise, there is a web class that represents a site, a top-level site or a child site. And also, when you create a client context, whatever site that you target is going to be available under client context.web. Now, let's look at something interesting. Let's say I go back, and I have an example here. I'm going to wait just a second before I step through and talk about how we're authenticating. But let's just look at this code right here. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to reach across the network, and I'd like to figure out the current site and what is the title. But now what I'm going to do is let's go ahead and get rid of this one call to client context.load. So junior engineer Jimmy gets a hold of a client context, says client context.web, he has a site, and then figures site.title. Let's go ahead and write that out to the console. So we'll go ahead and run this right here. And what you're going to see is I get an error because I have a client-side proxy object, and since my code has never made a round trip to the SharePoint front-end web server, how could it possibly be filled with any meaningful data? So one of the things that's very different for people who are transitioning from the server-side object model to the client-side object model is this need to populate the objects that you want to query. And one simple way I can do it is with a client context.load. And then the client context.execute query is actually where you're forcing your code to make a round trip call to the SharePoint front end web server into the client.svc entry point. Okay. Now, once we've seen that right here, I guess I should run this sample one more time so people can see it worked. No smoking mirrors here. Okay, let's go ahead. Now, this is a typical strongly typed piece of .NET code that's written against the assemblies, the .NET assemblies for the client-side object model. Now, there's also a client-side object model that's accessible via JavaScript. And there is a set of JavaScript files that are part of SharePoint that are automatically linked to with the master pages that come out of the SharePoint. SharePoint master pages that we use for things like SharePoint hosted app development. And I've just taken the sample of code that they load into a new SharePoint hosted app project. Now, some of the things to note is when you're inside the browser, you can't call execute query because it's a synchronous method and it would basically have the effect of freezing the user interface experience inside the browser. So when you use the client-side object model from JavaScript, which is often called JSON, what you're going to see is that you need to execute your calls asynchronously and use callback methods that actually pick up the response and are able to act upon something, you know, such as taking a result set and populating some part of the page to show the data that has just come back. Now, when we start working with authentication using the client-side object model, the client-side object model supports both user authentication and app authentication. Now, user authentication can use either Windows Auth or forms-based authentication. There's techniques that you can authenticate against your Office 365 site as a particular user. And if that's the case, you could write a console app or a desktop app, and you could use CSOM where just the user uses his or her credentials to connect, and then your CSOM code can do whatever the user can do. And that's a very productive way to use CSOM that doesn't even involve the SharePoint app model at all. But what a lot of folks are now doing is using the app model to create provider-hosted apps or SharePoint-hosted apps, and now we're writing CSOM code either in the JavaScript code behind our pages or in the server-side C# code that's being executed in the remote web. Now, when it comes time to authenticate from the remote web, there's a couple different ways that we can do it. Now, with Visual Studio 2012, when you created a provider-hosted SharePoint app project, they add a token helper class. So we're able to use a method in token helper, which is get client context with access token. Now, back in Visual Studio 2012, they didn't have the SharePoint context class. It wasn't added till Visual Studio 2013. The reason that they added the SharePoint context class was to provide more productivity and also to mask the differences between using OAuth in Office 365 and using S2S authentication in on-premise farms. And there's this idea that there's two different types of SharePoint context, one for ACS, one for S2S, and they just load the right one in. So the long and short of it is it's easier to go with the SharePoint context provider.current and get the SharePoint context, because once you've got that, you can simply say SP context create user client context for SP host. They have one for the host web, they have one for the app web, and they also give you ways to create the client context with an app only token as well as a user token inside there. Now, let's go ahead and move back to this slide right here. Now, one of the things I wanted to show, I showed this a little bit earlier, but I just want to revisit this from what I showed in an earlier lecture. But if you go to a SharePoint site inside your Office 365 tenancy, And then we look at this one particular page, which is the AppReg new page. What you're able to do is you're able to create a app security principle. And the idea then is that your CSOM code can connect using the identity of the app instead of the identity of the user, or in addition to the identity of the user. So there's the process of going through and adding the secrets inside. Once again, there's this one little trick where if you use a local host here, then SharePoint doesn't really care where the call is coming from. However, you can also add a domain, and then what SharePoint will do is it will ensure that that call is really coming from the domain you specified. Now, I've already created one of these app security principles, and once we've created the app security principle, let's go ahead and create this right here. Once you create this app security principle, there is also a way that you can go in and configure permissions inside there. So I've already done these for my demo. I just kind of want to show you the steps. Once you've created this, that you have an app security principle, but it has no permissions to do anything inside there. So there is another page, which is called appinv.aspx. And one of the things about this is, quite often, it's going to try to fill it in with an app instance, which is not going to take you to the page you want. You just want to go to the app ID page inside. But if you take a URL and you bring this back, what you have is you have that app security principle, and now you can put some permissions inside here. Now, the next part I'm going to show you is grungy. I apologize on the part of all of us for how grungy this is going to be. But what we need to do is put some app security permissions inside there. So if I create a app, and the app that I'm going to create is going to be just a throwaway, so I'll just call this one trash. But the reason that I want to create this right here is that I can use the app manifest designer to add some app permissions inside. So for instance, if I now, once this is created, we go to the app manifest, and what permissions do I want? You know, maybe I want to work at the site collection and have managed permissions. Maybe I want to be able to write managed metadata. And I'm going to go ahead and say, allow the app to make app-only calls. Now that I've done this right here, I'm going to right-click and choose View Code. And what that's going to do, it's going to show me this app permission requests. Here's the ugly part. I copy. I go back over here. I paste this. Not quite the elegant user experience that you might like. But for getting things done and configuring permissions, we'll go ahead, click OK. And now it's asking me, do you trust this app security principle? And now we've created the app security principle. We've configured permissions for it. And so now what we're going to be able to do is utilize that. So back to this last demo that I was doing, I created the app security principle in the exact same way that I did. Next, we basically go to the NuGet package manager, and there is this one package, which is the app for SharePoint Web Toolkit that usually gets added to the remote web project, but I just added to a regular console application inside here. And once you've done that, the Token Helper class is something that just looks for well-known app settings. So I went to the app config, and I've added in the client ID and the client secret. So basically, this is the app identifier, and this acts as the app password to get in. Obviously, you might want to conceal these, not let these get into unwanted hands, because it is a password. And there is permissions that you've allocated to that inside. But now what we're able to do is, in a fairly easy sense, to have batch-driven programs just from any old Windows machine. Or you could take the next step, take this console application, package it up, and deploy it to Windows Azure as a web job, which then you don't even need a desktop machine. You could basically just go to Azure and fire the console application to do any type of CSOM work you want to do against a SharePoint site. And so here, just to step through this code right here, token helper, get realm from target URL, and this gives you back a tenancy. And then you can get the access token by calling Token Helper get app only access token. And now get client context with access token. This gives me back the client context. And the main thing about this is as it calls in, it has a special authorization header that has the OAuth access token inside there. Okay. Now, final thing we want to do in this section is just introduce this idea of remote air handling. Now, why is remote air handling important? It's important because of the optimization of being able to do five operations and batch them all together into a single round trip. Okay, so let's look at a scenario. You have code that needs to create three different lists, and you want to optimize performance, so you want to batch them together. And so you'll have code to create list one, list two, and list three, and then you call execute query. And that sends the request to create all three across the network. What happens if it's able to create list one, but as it tries to create list two, it fails because there's already an existing list that has the same title or the same URL? So what should your code do? Should it just give up and return back? Should it just go on and try to create list three? And the answer is you have absolutely no control unless you start utilizing remote exception handling or remote air handling. Now, here's just a peek at getting started. There is this one particular class, which is the exception handling scope. Now, at a high level, the people that wrote this API, the client-side object model, are trying to simulate try-catch blocks that you know of in languages like C#, VB.NET. Hey, did you know JavaScript has try-catch blocks?
JavaScript
you knew
does
that,
have,
yes, okay.
JavaScript does have that.
Can't trip up Andrew Connell. But the idea is it can't be a language feature because it's not. So it's a API that's trying to simulate a language feature. So what you'll do is you'll create an exception handling scope and you'll pass the client context inside there. Now, you'll have this top block at which you start a scope. And then, just like try-catch blocks in C# or VB.NET, you have to have a try block, and then you have to have at least a catch block or a finally block, or you can have both. But if you don't do it correct, it's not a compile time error, because what you're doing is you're just putting together a big batch of XML, and it's not going to be till runtime that you send the request across, and they start parsing through it, and they see that you've started a scope that doesn't have a try block. It's going to fail. Or you have a scope that has a try block, but no associated catch or finally block. The other thing that trips a lot of people up is nowhere inside of the scope can you add a call to execute query. That always has to be at the end. So a lot of people try to put that, you know, inside of the try block, and it basically that will fail as well. Okay, and we'll see some examples of actually using remote air handling coming up, but the thing to see is that remote air handling can get complex. You can have a try block inside of a try block inside of a try block, and there could be scenarios where that's going to be important. However, what you'll see is if you're trying to do 10,000 things at once, you're going to have a very complicated set of remote air handling that's required to make sure that your code works properly. However, if you decide just to not worry about performance, but just do one thing, execute query, another thing, execute query, you don't need as much or maybe any remote air handling. So there's this balance between adding complexity but getting higher performance and reducing complexity but having more round trips, you know, basically yielding less performance inside there. And that's the trade-off that all of us fight as we start trying to do more and more complicated things.
Yeah, there's no right or wrong answer. It's something that you've just got to kind of figure out on your own on which on how much you want to add into it, how much you want to try and do in one big batch, or how much you want to actually try and do in individual little batches. So, yeah.
Exactly right. Okay, so now we're going to move to our next section, optimizing the execution of client-side object model queries. So let's look at this piece of code right here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my web object here, the variable name site, and we're going to load that up, and we're going to load the lists inside there, and we're going to call execute query. Now, I don't want to show the user every single list. I just want to show the user the lists that are not hidden. So I'm not showing things like the master page gallery. But what this code does is it brings all the lists, whether they're hidden or not, back to this program or this code, and then you start filtering out. What you don't want to do is bring 10,000 items across the network to filter down to 17 of them. We'd rather send the where clause back to the back end so we only send the data that we need. Also, when I say load the site, what does it really load up? And what you're going to see is it loads all the scalar properties. Now, if we look at this screenshot right here, if I call load.site, it's going to load all kinds of things as far as the language, the master URL, the recycle bin enabled, true or false, and it's got a pretty big footprint going across the network. So what I might do is I might decide to start optimizing things by using Lambda expressions. Now, let's go back here, and let's take this call right here, and let's say that if I wanted just the title back, we're gonna add a second argument, and this is the Lambda expression. Now, the first part of the Lambda expression is the parameter list, and the parameter list is already well-defined because it's the site that you see to the left. What name you come up with, any name that you want, except that thing to the left. So I'm gonna go ahead and call mine S, and now I can say S.title. And so here I've done an optimization to only bring back the title inside there. Now, if we look at this right here, you know, once again, you have the value or the parameter list, which is just a variable name that you make up. Next, you have the Lambda operator. Seriously, I had one student who for 45 minutes was too afraid to ask me where the Lambda operator key was on the keyboard until I had to tell him it was two keystrokes.
It's right next to the any key.
That's right. And then finally, you have a statement block in the back. So what we're going to do is we're going to switch from using this type to using this type of request, because now we can specify exactly what we want back. In this case right here, I only want the title. But now look at the footprint of what's coming across the network. You might imagine some scenarios it's not going to make a hill of beans difference between the two, but in other scenarios where you're doing thousands of things, having, you know, your data bloated to 10 times bigger than it could be is obviously going to be something that's not optimized.
Yeah, and when you see this, when you pop open Fiddler and when you watch the two different requests go back and forth, I mean, just in this simple example, I think that the second one is somewhere around like a seventh or an eighth of the size that actually comes back. So it can make a not only a speed impact, but it can also have a pretty big impact on the amount of bandwidth that's going back and forth. So if you're doing this on like a mobile device, it can have a big effect.
Exactly right. Now, what if you have more than one? Well, if I have more than one, notice that we have a parameter array. So if I wanted to put in 100, I could. And note that while the variable site here and this one can't be the same or there'll be an error, I can keep using the same. I can keep using S here to basically say S.URL. You know, so by writing your statements like this, you can specify exactly what properties you'd like to bring back as you load a single item.
It's worth noting too that that syntax that you just wrote down, you don't want to do that in two separate load statements. You really want to do that in one single load statement like you had there on the in the code. Is if you had it in two different ones, when that code got to the server, it would be effectively making two database calls on the server to get one for the title and then one for the URL. This is going to be just one database call where it does like select title comma URL instead of select title and then select URL in two different calls. So it's better to chain them together like this.
Exactly right. Okay, now let's go to the next step. How about the scenario where you don't want all the lists, you just want all the lists that are not hidden. So let's look at these two different examples. The first one where I say load site.lists. The next one where I say load site.lists, but now we put in the Lambda expression, lists, Lambda operator, list.where. So now what we're doing is we're leveraging the where extension method that was added in link back in .NET 3.5. And this allows us to specify when I bring back a collection, what are the properties I want to populate for each item in the collection. So this basically is allowing me to pass the where clause that basically says bring back lists where each list does not have the hidden attribute set to true. And I could and or together other where clauses inside here. Now, I misspoke in just a second. What I meant to say secondly is, in addition to the where extension method, we also see the include extension method. This is when you bring back a collection of items, you get to specify what properties for each item that you want to load. And if you don't specify that, it's just going to be like you've loaded all the scalar properties for the site. If I bring back all the lists, it's going to load a bunch of unnecessary properties. Now, note that unlike the WHERE extension method, include is not part of link, but it was created by the SharePoint team because there was nothing in link that really gave us this capability. So include will be new to many developers, where WHERE might be something that you've used before. And now down below here, you can kind of see, how things are going to work when you use the syntax to load these both together. You know, maybe the code at first looks a little encrypted, but at the end of the day, if you start embracing this style of programming, you're going to be moving data across the network in a much more efficient manner. Okay, now let's go back to a demo. Now, the first demo that I showed you was not a SharePoint app. So because you bared with me, I will now reward you by moving over to a SharePoint provider-hosted app inside here, and one created with MVC. So when you create a new SharePoint provider-hosted app and you pick MVC, they create the remote web as a MVC project inside there. They automatically add references to client and client.runtime. So what I've done here is I've created a couple different models. The first one is going to be the SharePoint Site Manager. And so what I've done here is to basically create a class with a static method, which is called getSitePropertys. And the idea is that the code that calls this will create the client context and pass it in. And given the client context, this is now going to do all the work. Now, because we're using MVC, it gets to be very beneficial to have well-known objects and object collection types that you pass back. So in this case right here, we're going to create a dictionary that has a string key and a string value. And then what we're going to do is we're going to make the call inside here. I know what you're thinking, Andrew. You just told us never to call load site. You should have the lambda expressions to dial in these. Point taken. But once we've called execute query, now we've made a round trip to SharePoint and back. We have the data that we need. So now we're going to build a dictionary. We're going to populate it with information inside there, and we're going to pass that back. Now, as far as who is going to utilize this, if we look at my home controller right here, here's my home controller, and my home controller is going to get the SharePoint context and then create user client context for the SP host, and it's going to call get lists. Now I have get list one and get list two. Let me go back here to the actual code, and yes, in our case right here, we're still calling the first one, which is get properties inside. But what you can see is that once we've made a call to get properties, one MVC technique is to create this dictionary and then pass it back to the view in the view bag under site properties. And then the final piece is if I go down to views and we look at this index view right here, I've tried to kind of keep things simple and I say site properties and then I build a HTML table. We have a for each loop in our Razor view that looks at each of the properties inside there, pulls out the key, pulls out the value, and is able to populate that in the screen right here. Now, inside this sample, I also wanted to kind of show you how we can also get at lists. So I have get list one, which uses a more naive method of just loading the site and site.lists. And then once the lists come back, going through there and getting rid of the ones that are hidden, and also getting rid of the ones that have base type anything other than zero. So basically that's show me the list, but not the document libraries. And then I have the second one that basically uses the optimizations that we just talked about right here. Yeah. The other thing is that sometimes you want to use the lambda expressions to only include certain things, like the title. But there's other times where you'll try to find something like a default view. And if you say, load and you load a list, it doesn't automatically add the default view URL. You have to explicitly ask for that to get it back. So in this case right here, we're going to build another dictionary, but this time we're also going to build the links into the default view. And what that gives us the ability to do is now get these back, find our particular list, be able to get to the list, and see them inside there. Okay, let's keep going. Now, the next thing that we are going to look at is creating lists and creating document libraries. Now, when we create objects with a client-side object model, in the majority of cases, the client-side object model has a class that ends with creation information. So I'm going to use a list creation information object and also a list item creation information object in the next demo to basically create things inside of our host web. Now, when we look at this code right here, once you have the client context, you can create the list information object. I'm going to create an announcements list. I'm going to give it a URL. Just to reiterate, I think I've pointed this out before, but when you create lists, always make sure that you put them in the list root folder. But if you're creating a document library, you want to put its root folder at the root of the site. Now here, we're going to create a list. We're going to basically have it be a 104 or the announcements list type. We're then going to add the list to the list collection of the site. Now I could call execute query here and create the list, but also I can get the list item back, make a couple more modifications to it, things that aren't possible to do through the list creation information object, such as whether you want it to show up on the quick launch bar, whether you want to enable attachments, and then we call update, and then we call execute query to do everything in one fell swoop. Now, also, here's where we're going to bring the remote error handling back in. So here's a case right here. When I create a list, I don't want my code to fail if a list of the same title already exists. So I'm going to use remote exception handling to get the list of that title and delete it. And if that results in an exception because there is no object there and it's a kind of a server-side null reference exception, I'm going to have a start catch that doesn't do anything.
That's the best kind of error handling. Just quiet it away.
That's right. Just sit on the rocker and stare into the woods. Okay. Now, let's also take a look at creating the list items inside right here. So if I go back to my demo and we take a look at this final piece of it, which I'm going to go back to the other demo. And we'll now take a look at the list manager. And so we have a create announcements list. So basically this is a method that is one of my models. Now, let's go ahead and kind of see the user experience here. I want to create a list. So someone clicks on this and they get to a particular page. And what we want to be able to do is have someone click on a button that's going to do an action such as creating a particular list. Now, inside of this controller, I'm actually kind of now showing some things for people who are newer to MVC. Let's go ahead and notice that we have a create lists that is nothing other than something that returns a view. And when we look at create lists creates a form. And the reason we want to do that is we might want to post to some other action that's defined by the controller. So here I have a create list page and I have a create announcements list button and also a complementary create actions list action that we've defined inside the controller class. But notice that this next one is an HTTP post. And so one of the things that gets to be a common technique to use here is that if I come back here and we take a look at create lists, notice that I can create an HTML form, and then I can specify what is the action when someone clicks on that button. I can also specify what is the controller. Here I only have a home controller, but if you had multiple controllers, it's important to keep that. And then also there's something about using the SharePoint MVC infrastructure, which has a filter, which kind of expects that we always have a SP host URL. So another really important part of this demo where things would fall apart if I didn't do that is when someone clicks on this button right here, or when we redirect, we want to make sure that we're always repropagating the SP host URL parameter inside there. Now, if I go ahead and I click on this right here, what's it going to do? It's going to basically run through this code. And so the code that we have inside here, let's go back and look at our home controller. Also note that I also use the anti-forgery token inside here. And the idea is that we have something that is analogous to the request digest or form digest in SharePoint, something that will detect tampering. So when you have form data, it's just a good security mechanism to have inside there. So by virtue of the fact that you have added the anti-forgery token, and then we're also looking for it inside here, is what puts that security layer in place. But then we'll just get the SharePoint context and we'll call create announcements list inside of our SharePoint manager class. If I go back here to the SharePoint site manager class, and I'm sorry, SharePoint list manager class, and we take a look at this. So ultimately this is going to be called. And so what we have here is something that's going to create the announcements list inside here using code that you've seen on the slides. In just a second, we'll talk about hooking up the remote event receiver. That's the last thing I'm going to talk about in the next section. But then here's also some code that's going to go through and add a couple different list items. Okay. Now, note that if I look back at the home controller, what this is going to do is it's going to basically do the post. It's going to call the code that creates the announcement list. And then at the very end, I'm going to redirect back to the page that shows all the different lists. So at the end of the day, you should now be able to see announcements. That's the list that was just created. Let's go ahead and click on there. And what's important to see is that this was created inside the host web, not the app web, in the place that SharePoint users are used to getting their work done. So your C# code or your VB.NET code can just basically start populating the user sites with all kinds of list document libraries and populate them with list items and documents inside. Okay, and so that was the demo of basically creating lists using the client-side object model. One more last section we have, and that's registering remote event receivers. Now, we have a upcoming module that's going to drill down on remote event receivers, their architecture, the debugging, and a lot more detail. Here, we just want to see the CSOM code to hook things up. So, first thing is that you actually have to create a remote event receiver implementation. Now, once again, we'll go into some more detail in a later module, but we have an announcements event receiver.svc file inside there. And that has basically some events that we're going to register, but it's got some code that's going to look at the title. It's going to do some simple validation. I wanted to pick out some type of example that wouldn't offend any humans. So I just sent it to offend crustaceans. So you're not allowed to type the word lobster or clam into the title inside there. You know, so if we kind of take a look at, you know, what is the effect of this, and that is that, you know, I love lobster. The effect of this remote event receiver is that no one's going to be able to send something inside there. And same thing, you try to do it with a clam, that's not going to work. But if you say something like, you know, I love C#, that's going to work fine. And then the other behavior that's inside this is to take the text and bounce it to uppercase. So once again, I'm just going to show this real quick and I'll walk through it a little bit in more detail later. But we have an event handler that basically looks at the incoming content. And if it finds one of those offending words, it sets the status to cancel with error. But also, it takes the title and it basically bounces it to uppercase as one of the before events. Now, the code that's important here, this code really doesn't involve CSOM, but the code over here does. And that is that you could say http context.current.request.url get left part. So basically, you're finding the entry point that SharePoint needs to know to call into the entry point for your event handler inside there. Then we create one of these. Look at the name of this class, Event Receiver Definition Creation Information. We go ahead, we create these, we add them inside there. And as long as you've got everything stood up, we're going to be able to basically run this and get our event handling in place right there. Okay, so in closing, we looked at the client-side object model. Much against Andrew's wishes, I told you there were some times where you could use the client-side object model instead of REST. But I think over the next couple years, you're going to see that choosing the SharePoint REST API or CSOM, you know, different people will have different scenarios, and you can choose either one, and given your scenario, it could be a good choice. There was a couple things, such as batching, that might make CSOM a better candidate for doing high-performance code for various scenarios, especially when you're moving lots of data across the network and you're trying to minimize round trips. And we saw some simple examples of getting everyday work done, you know, such as creating lists, creating list items, and registering remote event receivers. Okay, so why don't you close up here?
Ted, that was a great module. I think you may not have convinced me to actually jump over on the CSOM piece. You did have the lobster and clam contingent, but I think you lost them at the very end. So I think they're still staying on my side on the REST side. So the Office team has got a lot of great content and able to help you get ramped up and get started. You go to dev.office.com. You'll be able to see a lot of stuff about links to video training, to tutorials, to labs. There's a link and some information about how you get the latest dev tools and how you get signed up for a test developer tenant with Office 365. And there's also a link to an API sandbox that you can go check out the Office 365 APIs in a live environment. And more APIs are going to be added to that as well going forward. As far as feedback goes, Microsoft is really interested in your feedback. There's three great ways to participate. On Yammer, there's a Office 365 network where you can actually have discussions with other people and with people on the Microsoft product team. If you have questions, technical questions or end-user questions, Stack Overflow is a fantastic place to go. Just make sure you tag your questions with MS-Office so that it's pretty easy to find those. And last but not least, if you have feedback for the product team, you want to ask for a new feature, you want to have any opinions on changing existing features, go to UserVoice, that's officespdev.uservoice.com, where you can submit your own ideas and people can vote on them. They triage those things on a very frequent basis to see, add things if they're going to be added to the product and to look at those different sorts of things. And then finally, too, all the stuff that you saw Ted talk about in this module, make sure you go to github.com/officedev. In there, there's a repository called Training Content. That's where you'll find all of the Office Dev MVA content that we've been using in this module and in other modules within this course. You can get hands-on labs for the stuff that Ted was showing you here in this module, as well as all of our other modules and stuff. So it's a great resource for you to go grab, see all the slides, see all the demos and all the sample code as well. Great place to go. And so with that, thank you very much for watching this this module. And the next module will come back and start jumping on with a couple more building block stuff. Thanks a lot.